you have no privacy, so get over it, right? And the reality is that we have to manage our privacy. We have to say, what things are we willing to give up to get the advantages that come with giving it up?
What will you be giving up this new year? An end-of-the-year look ahead by a man whose job it is to look ahead. And our Rio Pacino looks into his virtual crystal ball to see where the world of gaming is going. Also, part two of a look into the future of person-to-person online loans. This is PodTech News Weekly Magazine for December 30th, 2006. For Jason Lopez, I'm Paul Landcor. Do you think 2007 will be an even bigger year for blogs? Are you already thinking ahead to what lies beyond the release of Microsoft Vista? Each year, the Gartner Research Group releases a set of 10 key predictions for the future. PodTech's Clark Boyd checked in with Gartner analyst Daryl Plummer about the group's IT predictions for the year ahead.
Many of Gartner's key predictions for 2007 and beyond are counterintuitive. For example, IT outsourcing will continue to be an avenue to corporate growth, right? Not so, according to Gartner. The group predicts that revenue for the top 10 outsourcers will actually decline by more than $5 billion over the next 2 years. And if that finding piques your interest, just hear what Gartner research partner Daryl Plummer has to say about blogging.
Blogging is one of those internet phenomena that everyone jumps on. And it's interesting because it's gone through this explosion of interest, and there have been millions and hundreds of millions of bloggers out there. And the only thing that's a problem is that the life cycle of a blog is not that long. I mean, maybe on the order of 3 months. And so there may be a lot of blogs coming into the marketplace, but a lot of them are going out at the same time. And because of that, and also because of the fact that people are getting used to it, and they're getting used to what it's all about and trying to figure out how to do things that are valuable to them with blogs. So I've said many times, people think they all have something to say until they're put on stage and have to say it. And then it becomes more of an issue of, do you have anything continually to say?
Yeah, do you have something to say every day? That's the question.
Absolutely. The blogging prediction that we have is actually one that says that blogging and community contributors to bloggers are going to peak in the first half of 2007. And we're looking at TechnoRowdy numbers of 56 million active weblogs in October 06. And you know, we're seeing a decline on that. The lifespan is 3 months of those blogs, and it's going down. We're seeing that the bloggers that are out there are on the decline as well, the number of bloggers totally. And we're seeing that people are getting smarter about how they use blogs. You know, marketers are beginning to use them to market, and communities that are out there like MySpace and Facebook, where people come together to share information about one another, are being assaulted more and more by these marketers who are looking to market to those communities.
Is there a sense that if blogging does in fact peak and maybe even go down a little bit, does that diminish their impact, or do they continue to have a big impact?
Actually, the impact tends to go up, because what's left is really the cream of the crop. Skilled marketers are going to really take advantage of this, but the information that's out there is coming from people who have something to say, who have figured out how to keep a thread going for a time and are serving a community with information that community cares about.
Right. Well, one of the really interesting findings that I saw on the list of the top 10 was that by the end of 2007, 75% of enterprises will be infected with undetected, financially motivated, targeted malware that evaded their traditional perimeter and host defenses. I mean, that's incredible.
Well, one of the things is that we've said for many years that a lot of the security threats that the companies face are undetected ones, and the most dangerous ones will go undetected. We're getting better at detecting things at this time, but still, there's a lot of undetected, influence from hackers and from malware that's going on out there. Some of it is not particularly damaging, but increasingly, the security threat is financially motivated, as opposed to someone just saying, "I want to show the world that I can do it." You see, and when you think of malware, you're looking at a situation where security products are designed to stop things that they recognize as a threat. Okay. If, however, that we look at these organizations being seeing these bits of malware that are not necessarily recognized as a threat, they get past the perimeter defenses. They get installed and they get propagated within a company as opposed to getting blocked or getting flagged as something that someone needs to take care of. So everyone is pretty much ignorant. They're blissful in that ignorance, and, and thinking that the antivirus or the network scans are going to say, okay, there's no infection being shown, so we're okay. You know, the problem is with that is that increasingly malware is coming into the system not looking like these threats that we typically recognize. They are intended to actually disguise themselves. They're intended to come in as sort of Trojan horses in the environment and begin to work their way into our financial systems. And that's why this is such a big threat.
Now, the other corporate finding that you had that I was interested in is you guys are saying that Vista will be the last major release of Microsoft Windows. What trend do you see there as far as how they will switch or how companies will switch to, you know, getting their operating systems out?
Well, this is actually going to be true of many software products in the marketplace. And the idea of Vista being the last major release is really highlighted by the fact that the integrated architecture of Microsoft that they've built on for years is not really sustainable over time, and they know this. And when we look at this, what we're seeing is the ability to incrementally update a more modular architecture for operating system is going to become the norm. So incremental updates that deal with subsystems as opposed to a generic monolithic release that deals with all systems coming out at once. This is beneficial to new businesses because they really want to have an easier way to deploy and manage the changes. They don't want to have to go through these fire drills to actually do the upgrades every 3 years that they've gone through. They want to be able to have a more consistent way to do the updates, to get the testing done and get the deploying done and absorb the changes. So that is going to make it easier, actually, not only for a Microsoft to deliver the product, but for businesses that use Windows to absorb the product in the long run. And we're going to see a lot of changes like this from packaged application vendors selling their packages as monolithic packages down to incremental updates of these packages over time.
Now, the one last one that I want to hit on is you also predict that by 2010, 60% of worldwide cellular users will be trackable via an emerging follow me internet. Can you tell me a little bit about that finding?
Certainly. The idea of trackable cell phone signals is not something new. I mean, all cell phones are trackable and can be triangulated as far as location. What really is new is the idea is that being able to use location as a service is important to companies, knowing where their resources are, knowing where their people are, knowing whether those people are in places where they need to be, and taking advantage of that, you know, making sure that the right data is associated with them and so forth, is going to be something that companies see more and more as a value proposition. It's not so much that the companies want to track the people to steal their privacy, although that is an issue. It is also the idea that, you know, you want people to be able to access things from wherever they are, and if their location is important to the services that they're trying to provide or to the activities they're engaging in, then that's a good thing. So this trackable follow me internet idea is about not only, you know, is about mobility, and it is about resource management, and it is about privacy. All of those things come together, and we have to figure out how we're going to use that to our best advantage. We've spent years with with corporations tracking their physical assets, and now we have to see how corporations begin to track their human aspects and human assets to leverage them to good advantage.
And you think that that'll continue to grow despite, I mean, obviously there are going to be privacy concerns about this, you think that the incentives will outweigh the privacy concerns in the long run?
Certainly they will. They tend to. Historically, security is always brought up as a barrier, but security gets overturned essentially as a barrier because of mechanism, technology, and advantage, opportunity comes about. We can see situations where children need to be tracked. And that is an advantage. And when you start thinking about the fact that in your life you like to have the advantage of tracking where your child is, it's easier for you to apply that to your company needing to track where you are or where your people or your coworkers might be in a given system. Certainly, people will continue to say this is a privacy issue, but you can always turn a cell phone off. You know, you can always disconnect from the network, and when you're doing something that is not corporate related. But if you're in a corporate event, then the company and that information, you could arguably say it is not necessary privacy. Scott McNeely, ex-CEO of chairman of Sun, said that you have no privacy, so get over it, right? And the reality is that we have to manage our privacy. We have to say what things are we willing to give up to get the advantages that come with giving it up. And I think that the advantage will tend to outweigh the downside of this.
Daryl, thanks a lot.
Well, I appreciate you having me.
Daryl Plummer is a Gartner research partner. In Boston, this is Clark Boyd for PodTech. Happy New Year, everybody.
Next-gen console. It was a term that was kicked around a lot in gaming news in 2006. Microsoft's Xbox 360 took online gaming to another level with its Xbox Live service. Plus, Sony and Nintendo unveiled shiny new consoles just in time for the holiday season. With the release of the 360, PlayStation 3, and Wii, will 2007 be an even bigger year for gaming? PodTech's Rio Pacino has that story.
2006 ended with a bang for the video game industry with the highly anticipated release of the Sony PlayStation 3 and the Nintendo Wii. Now that all three next-gen, or now current-gen consoles are out, what do gamers have to look forward to come 2007? What problems will the industry face next year? And will Halo 3 ever come out for the Xbox 360? In this podcast, GameSpot.com editor Brad Shoemaker takes on the role of a fortune teller and answers those very questions, and also gives his gaming predictions for 2007.
All three of those systems are out now. We're fully in the next generation. I guess next generation is now this generation.
Right. I'm sick of that buzzword, next gen. It's not next gen anymore.
It's getting old.
Right.
But the biggest thing I've been thinking about lately is that I think this is the most heated and contentious race between consoles that I can remember ever seeing. I mean, all three of these consoles have really obvious advantages to them right now. Like the 360 started a year ago, obviously they've got their year-long head start, so they've got a big installed base, they've got a lot of really well-made games because their developers have had all this extra lead time. The Wii is cheap. It's also it's showing a lot of appeal to the mainstream gamer, or even, you know, the mainstream consumer that isn't into games. You know, that seems to be, that was Nintendo's target, and it seems to be what's actually happening.
Right.
And then the PlayStation 3, obviously, is a PlayStation, and it's just going to keep going and going on that name alone. I mean, they also have the promise of their Metal Gear, their Final Fantasy. They've got all their big exclusives coming in the future, so people are looking forward to those. But even now, even with their shaky launch, you know, with their kind of dearth of really banner titles on launch day, you know, it's still going to keep flying off shelves just because it's a PlayStation. So,
right. So are you saying your first prediction, you're going to predict who's going to win this war?
No, I'm predicting that there is no way to predict actually what's going to win, because they all seem to, you know, they all have, you know, they're kind of feathers in their caps, you know, right now.
Right. I mean, you go with the 360. I mean, they have the Xbox Live service.
Yeah, Xbox Live
successful.
Definitely.
I'm on that. I'm assuming you're on that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I want your gamer tag after this interview.
Fair enough.
Game, but. You know, with a Wii, you got that controller. I mean, it's unique. You don't have anything like it. Of course, there have been a few complaints about Wii injuries going on with that.
Broken TVs.
But some guys are just getting too into the game. You know, and like you said, Sony with the reputation. I mean, just the PlayStation name alone, like you said, will help them sell consoles and exclusives. I mean, I'm a Metal Gear fan. I'm also a Final Fantasy fan. So those two games alone probably will help them just a bit. So now, speaking of games, any predictions with games?
There's a number of really big games, as we're saying here. The Final Fantasy, they've got Final Fantasy 13 coming. They've got Metal Gear Solid 4 coming. Halo 3 is due next year. I'm guessing that you're not going to see at least one of those games next year.
Wow, really?
Well, yeah, just because, you know, the way development is going with this generation of systems, you know, it's becoming exponentially more difficult. They need a lot more man hours, a lot more money to make these games. And even though I know Halo and Metal Gear in particular have both said they're going to be out next year, I'm guessing that at least one of them is not going to be.
Halo 3, Metal Gear, the new Metal Gear.
Yeah.
Which one's not going to come out in 2007?
Oh, man. That's hard to say. I would probably guess that Metal Gear might not make it out.
And why is that?
Well, the PS3 is newer. They obviously have not had that much time to be working on it. It's obviously a really ambitious game. Hideo Kojima is saying this is his last Metal Gear, it sounds like. Of course, he's been saying that since, like, Metal Gear Solid 2, but they're positioning it as like the swan song of the current Metal Gear series with Solid Snake and all those characters. So as big and ambitious as it's going to be, and obviously PS3 being such a beast to develop for, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they decide they want to take the extra time to make sure that they really get it right. So
I hope it comes out next year, because that single game is going to determine whether or not I actually buy the system
personally. Yeah. It absolutely, Metal Gear Solid 4 will absolutely sell a whole ton of PlayStation 3s.
Right.
So, but and I would love to play it a year from now, but if they need the extra time to make it better, then I'm glad to wait a little bit longer.
So for all you Halo fans out there listening, Brad Shoemaker says, that's coming out next year.
Well,
don't
let's hope. Don't quote me. You know, this is all speculation. You know, we could be sitting here at this time next year with Halo, Metal Gear, and Final Fantasy all stacked on top of our TVs. But you know,
that'd be good for everybody.
Yeah, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Other predictions.
The format war that is still ongoing that Microsoft and Sony have taken very obvious sides on.
HD DVD versus Blu-ray.
Exactly. I don't think that's going to be decided next year, even though it's been going for a while now. I mean, people have been hearing about it and reading about the technologies for a while, and they're both on the market now. The adoption rate for both of those looks like it's pretty slow so far, just because HDTV adoption is still happening. You know, I mean, obviously the great mass of consumers has not made the switch over yet. DVDs are still really big. People have amassed enormous DVD collections over the past 8 or 9 years that that format's been out. DVDs look okay on HDTV if you have something decent that can upscale them to an HD resolution. So people already own all these movies and they don't look that bad. You know, I don't think people are going to be that compelled to take sides with HD DVD or Blu-ray.
Right.
It's a little more interesting the way that Sony is using PS3 is kind of like this Trojan horse to get the Blu-ray player into people's homes. You know, I don't know if that's going to make people go out and buy Blu-ray movies just because they have it or not. Microsoft has similarly made a cheap HD DVD solution available.
Right, the external.
Exactly.
HD
yeah.
DVDs.
Yeah. But then again, they've actually gone on record saying, if Blu-ray wins unequivocally, then you know they'll be happy to support Blu-ray in the future if they have to.
What happens if Blu-ray loses? What happens to the PlayStation 3?
Well, I'm sure it keeps going as a game system. I'm not sure how much money Sony has tied up in the R&D for the Blu-ray format, but obviously if it doesn't take off with movie studios and that kind of thing, that could be a tremendous blow to them. But yeah, I mean, obviously the PlayStation 3 is not going anywhere as a game system, even if Blu-ray movies don't happen as a trend with consumers.
So what other predictions you have for next year? I'm pretty sure you have a number. I'm looking at your list right
there. So. Sony has been throwing around the big 1080p banner for a long time, since well before the PlayStation 3 came out. They made this huge deal out of how their system was the only one that does 1080p. The Xbox 360 doesn't or didn't at that time. You know, you got to have a 1080p TV to get the most out of your games, blah, blah, blah. Then the PS3 comes out. Just about all of the launch games only run in 720p. And Microsoft has patched the 360 to enable 1080p output from that system. But all their games are also running in 720p. So my prediction with this is that 1080p is definitely not going to matter next year.
And I have a 1080p TV. I bought the new Sony XBR, the Bravia.
I'm extremely jealous.
A lot of people are, but at the same time, it's useless from a gaming perspective because my 360 doesn't even support that.
Right,
especially
right.
with the Sony. There's some problems with that. I don't know if you heard about that.
No.
But and plus, there's no HDMI cable.
Right.
You know, so what's the point of offering that patch when there's not even an HDMI cable offered with the 360?
Yeah, the 1080 output has been kind of gimped with the 360 for whatever reason. But I think the real issue in terms of games outputting at 1080 is just that developers don't want to sacrifice frame rate and also, you know, graphical effects in their games just to get it running at a higher resolution. I've had more than one development lead on a PlayStation 3 game tell me that they would rather make that trade-off and not run at 1080p and have extra smoke effects, particle effects, all that kind of stuff, and have a higher frame rate. And 720 looks pretty darn good still.
So do you think that whole notion of Sony, you know, overhyping 1080p with its console, and you predicting that that's not even going to be an issue come 2007. I mean, it pisses me off because of the fact that that's one of the biggest things they were promoting when the PlayStation 3 was about to be launched.
Right.
And now that it is out, I mean, there's not even any games that are being offered in 1080p.
Hardly. I think maybe Ridge Racer runs in 1080p, I believe.
I think you're right.
And I'm sure you'll be seeing, you know, they've got their downloadable games like Blast Factor and stuff. Like, the little more simplistic games graphically probably will be able to push to 1080. And maybe the same on the 360, who knows. We'll see some live arcade games maybe. I mean, you look at stuff like, something like Loco Roco on the PSP, which is graphically, it's really simplistic. You know, it's got kind of a minimalist style to it, but it still looks really good because of really strong art design. Mm-hmm. So you can see games like that where they don't push the technical limitations of the system so much, where they rely more on their just kind of their visual creativity. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe in those cases they could be doing 1080 more often, but I think all of your kind of, you know, like the Warhawks and the Metal Gears and anything that look, Gears of War, games like that that are really pushing the hardware, you know, I think the developer is always going to prefer to go with the slightly lower resolution, mm-hmm. and you know, push the game more in other ways.
Right. Any other predictions?
The last one on my list is about microtransactions, which really kind of came into their own this year.
Yeah. Microsoft points and all that.
Yeah, stuff. I think next year microtransactions are going to get worse before they get better. there were definitely some missteps with that thing. Or with the whole model this year, where you had like the Oblivion horse armor come out for $250, or like EA was selling stadiums.
What is up with that? I mean, charging for items that should be included in the game. I heard EA was offering, like you said, stadiums and Madden, alternate jerseys, but those are free now.
Oh, okay. Well, that helps.
Also, Godfather, they were selling codes.
I think that was, you know what? That's an even uglier trend with microtransactions.
Terrible.
Yeah, like where you're actually buying games where you're just paying more to unlock extra content that's already on the disc. You know, I can almost see an argument for it in the cases where they allow you to either unlock it through playing well or buying it. You know, that
but they
is
don't
a
give
little
you,
more justifiable.
They don't even give you that option.
If you don't even have the option to do anything but pay more money to access content that is on a disc you already bought, I mean, that's kind of despicable.
Brad, you're talking about making it's going to get worse. In what ways?
So all three consoles are out now, and each one of them has the infrastructure to facilitate this kind of microtransaction, downloadable content. Steam is huge on the PC, so it's a valid, you know, kind of content delivery system there too. So it's everywhere. It's not going anywhere. It's not going away. And this year you saw the signs of where some publishers are going to want to try to nickel and dime everybody to death just because they can. I think they're just testing consumers' limits right now to see what that new market will bear. You know, what they basically, I'm sure they basically, some evil executives are,
how far can we take it?
They're cackling wickedly in some boardroom going, you know, how little can we sell for how much money? You know, I mean, I think that the Oblivion horse armor is the perfect example, you know, because $2.50 for what was basically like a new texture or a new model for your horse. It didn't contribute to gameplay in any way. It's not even a multiplayer game, so nobody else could see that you had it. Mm-hmm. All it did was make your horse look different, and you spent $2.50 on that.
Right.
Fortunately, at least in Bethesda's case, the developer of Oblivion, the backlash was so huge from that they very quickly rectified their problems.
And that's good they did.
Yeah, like all of the subsequent content releases for Oblivion have been really substantive pieces of gaming content. They've got whole new quests and all that stuff. So,
right.
That company in particular looked at what they did wrong and fixed it. But then, like you were saying, we've got EA selling all this stuff, and other companies. You know, you have to figure. A lot of publishers haven't even tried it yet. So, we'll see what happens when they get into it.
I know 2K Sports with their NBA 2K7. They're offering this Reel Maker where you could put together your highlights into one package. I thought that was an option included in the game. Come to realize that it's not, and you have to pay extra for it.
That's shocking.
And I think that's something that's just terrible.
That sounds like the kind of, in fact, that is the kind of feature that has been in games like that in the past for free. I mean,
right.
They're only, it seems like, you know, I'm fine with microtransactions, downloadable stuff like this when it's something that obviously took the developer longer to make after release, or, you know, they thought of it later or something like that.
Yeah, but like an added patch.
Exactly, yeah. But if they're just holding back content just so they can charge more money for it piecemeal like that, that stinks.
Just when you think the gaming hype is dying down, a whole set of new topics set the rumor mill ablaze. Expect gaming issues like HD, DVD versus Blu-ray, who's going to win the console war, 1080p, microtransactions, and others to hit the fan come 2007. For PodTech News, I'm Rio Pacino.
Last week, we featured part one in our interview with Chris Larson. He headed up the highly successful eLoan and is now the co-founder and CEO of Prosper.com, a Web 2.0 lending marketplace. Today in part two, Larson explains further the details of Prosper's person-to-person lending structure. He spoke with PodTech's Michael Johnson.
Is there a cap as to how much the loans can go up to with Prosper.com?
Yeah, on the marketplace today, the loans range from $1,000 to a maximum of $25,000. At some point, we might go higher, but given the size of the market, that really makes sense. And then that really tackles that, I think, kind of the worst type of debt for borrowers, again, credit card debt and sort of small personal loans, that people have a hard time getting at reasonable prices. So that's the sweet spot of the market today, probably an increase going forward. Now, on the lender side, you can put a bid as low as $50, to back a loan. And what that means is typically one loan will have perhaps, 10, 50, 100, sometimes even 500 individual people who are lending to that borrower, which helps spread risk and helps lenders diversify.
Now, tell me about the group aspect, because that seems like that's a pretty interesting way of organizing the loans as well.
Yeah, we thought the idea of groups, it really speaks to kind of the way the credit systems used to be in America. If you look at the early building and loan societies, kind of think It's a Wonderful Life, the, Bailey Savings and Loan, Bedford Falls. What was important there is, it's a community, and there's always the sense that when someone's borrowing money, you're borrowing from your neighbor. Where is your neighbor's money? Well, it's in your other neighbor's farm or a business or house. And what that does is that really helps establish not only, hey, it's your credit on the line, but in fact, you're standing in the community. So that shame factor, that accountability factor, that's something that's been lost in when you look at big capital markets institutions, which have, while gotten efficient in allocating money, have really destroyed that sense of connectedness. And we think what the web is so great at doing is, we can replicate what the capital markets do in efficiency and in diversification. Lenders can spread the money around, but we can also get back that very tight sort of affiliation of borrower to their small group, however they define their community. And again, that could be physical or virtual, like a MySpace group, a Facebook group. But we think that's very, very important, to improve the repayment performance and really capture the value of shame, accountability, and reputation. And that's really what groups are all about.
And how's the performance of the groups or the loans for people been? And I know that obviously there's risk involved any time you loan money, but it seems like there's a couple of factors that you've got to know. You've got to know who you're lending money to, so you have to know, who the person is. How much do you have to know about the person that's borrowing in order to make it go forward?
We try to make it fairly simple. So borrowers are going to be sort of evaluated on a number of factors. First and foremost, their credit score, their credit grade. So when a borrower makes a listing, Prosper will take them through all the steps a bank or a credit card does in verifying them, making sure they're real, and then most importantly, pulling their credit history and expressing that as a credit grade, 1 of 8, best being AA, almost perfect, the worst being an HR, high risk, which might be very risky. So we put that data up on the listing, and there's some great information that lenders can use to then judge what they should be bidding. In addition to that, might be if they belong to a group, about 70% of borrowers do, is what's the reputation of the group? Groups earn a reputation based on how all of their members perform relative to how you thought they would perform. So you might look for the group ranking. We rank groups from 5 stars, rank them kind of like, power sellers on eBay. 5 stars to 1 star, 5 star being you're really outperforming the market, 1 star they're underperforming the market. So that might also be something that's very important for a lender to look at. And then, of course, it's the story, the link to their small business, what has been their experience. And perhaps even if a lender might know, of that person either through an alumni association or some other affiliation that might be related to the group. And that's typically how lenders evaluate people. I think there's a lot of data there. Lenders sort of addicting. People, it's a cross in some ways between stock trading and online dating in a way, where you are really evaluating, can I trust this person? Is this person worthy of my trust to give them my money and to allocate my resources to that loan?
Right. I also notice that people do post sometimes their pictures and personal stories about why they need the loan as well, right?
That's right. So borrowers can remain completely anonymous. Prosper will know their data. We'll have verified them. We'll give them a credit grade. They can stay completely anonymous. Only we'll ever know who they are, even when their payments are made. will be the pass-through. But most people, I think, know that if they're expressive, if they tell their story, that's going to drive more bids and probably better interest rates. So most people will put a picture, a story, links, all kinds of things, which are, we think, add a richness and a vibrance to the marketplace.
Can you tell me a story that, I don't know, a particular success or something that worked for you, I think, that really exemplifies, something that really exemplifies what Prosper.com is all about?
Yeah, we have just some great stories on the site. We've, we've made about 5,600 loans so far, about $26 million and $5,000 increments. So lots and lots of different stories there. But, you know, for example, we had this organic tea company here in San Francisco that was looking for, money to start another store. And, put a bid on there. What's great about that is you can link to the store, you can link to their the organic tea company's website, really tell the story as well as see the credit details and make the, kind of hard evaluation of the investment. But I would venture to say that there were people bidding on that. I think it had something like 300 people bidding. I would venture that some of their customers were probably bidders. And that's really an interesting thing in a way, because talk about sustainable models. You know, we think about the organic, kind of food trends, where consumers of food want to get close to where their food is made. Well, now you have this situation where customers can be sort of the investors or supporters of their local businesses. That's a great thing. It's very powerful, I think, in going both ways. And great stories like that. I can go on and on, but that's a very visual, powerful, and has been a good investment as well.
Well, it seems like an interesting cycle in a way, because as you were alluding to before, that this is the way that I guess in some ways I think the smaller communities used to make money available to members of the community. And it seems like that's a pretty large circle to come back to, using the social networking and the modern technology to do the same thing, which is kind of village lending in a way.
That's right. In many ways, you're exactly right. This is a step back. There's some things that really worked well, in many of those original systems that work very well. When we talk about micro-lending, there's usually at the village level, there's a lot of reputation and sort of that shame factor, and also the excitement factor of, getting to see what's happening with my money. Very different from your money sitting passively in a bank, just watching a online number statement and not knowing where the money is. So there's it's very powerful, I think, in that way, and it creates that sort of really local connection. But at the same time, gives you all the benefits of big capital markets, which are great at spreading risks. Again, the problem with the local systems, even Bedford Falls, It's a Wonderful Life, was when that Bedford Falls went in, had trouble, everybody's wiped out. So the idea that you can both be local, but also spread your money around and get all those benefits of a diversified portfolio, if you can merge those two things together, which you really can on the web now, that's really the home run.
I've been speaking today with Chris Larson, who is the CEO and co-founder of Prosper.com. That's Prosper, just like it sounds, Prosper.com. And I presume that there's some tutorials and demos online that folks can look at when they check out the website, Chris. Is that right?
That's right. Just an enormous amount of information to help all the group leaders, borrowers, and lenders, as well as a very active community, a very active discussion forum of other participants. And again, this market is really being built by the users. Prosper itself, we view ourselves really as a servant infrastructure, and it's people who are creating the product and creating the market.
Chris Larson, Prosper.com, thanks for being with us on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
I'm Michael Johnson, and you're listening to PodTech.net.
That's PodTech News Weekly Magazine for December 30th, 2006, and for all of 2006, for that matter. For Jason Lopez, I'm Paul Landcor. Thanks for listening, and have a great New Year.